Explore the tropics at Whole Foods Market through April 16th. Save on juicy finds like yellow mangoes at 5 for $5 with Prime. Sweet Dacopan citrus is back, just $3.49 per pound with Prime. Plus, save on seasonal favorites like dragon fruit, kiwi, pineapple, and more. In the meat department, pick up animal welfare certified meats with tropical-inspired marinades. And be sure to try the spicy Hawaiian pizza, back for a limited time, only at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. Brian Wilson was a musical genius and one of the greatest songwriters of all time. He caught melodies like they were waves. He bottled good vibrations like no one else. And he picked up bad vibrations, too. He broke down. He tripped hard. He didn't just hear music. He heard voices. He tried to lose those voices by making a teenage symphony to God called Smile. But somewhere along the way, Brian Wilson lost his mind instead. This is his story.
Hello to whoever is listening to this. It's Rhonda again. We're slowly coming to the end of all of these Brian Wilson tapes. There's only a few left now. This batch I'm going through at the moment seems to be from Brian's home recordings, and if I'm not mistaken, they make up most of the entire collection. These, just like some we've already seen, appear to be recorded on a dictaphone. He talks of pretty mundane tasks and sounds confused, even introspective at times. Here, have a listen.
I'm going to buy a new car today, but I can't do it on my own. They come everywhere with me, these people, these minders, or captors, is maybe more appropriate. They're Dr. Landy's people. Landy is like a god. He's omnipresent. Everywhere in my life. I can't escape. And freedom seems like an abstract concept to me now, like a dream. Although, maybe I wouldn't even want to if I could. Maybe I can exist without someone like that. I've been trying to write songs, but it's hit and miss. Sometimes the days just slide by like a bad dream. Some days I feel like I'm getting better, but other days I feel like I'm falling apart. I feel like I don't have a single friend in the world. Except this dictaphone, these words, my only friends are these thoughts now. All I have is myself, my thoughts, and a whole load of blood on the tracks.
Chapter 8. Brian Wilson is back?
This is 105.4 BRIAN-FM. I'm sorry to tell you this, but we're shutting down our broadcast. We've been forced to by the people in charge. This is BRIAN-FM signing off for forever. Goodbye.
I still remember waking up in my bed. The world seemed fuzzy, colder, and more real than it had been for years. It was scary. The last thing I remember is a handful of pills. Then the radio that was playing sounded strange. Then it all went black, like I was totally submerged into the darkness. Then I woke up here. I felt like I'd woken from the deepest sleep imaginable.
Like a dream.
I didn't know if I was alive or dead, if this was some form of an afterlife, but I understood where I was the second I turned my head and laid eyes on him. The moment I saw him, I knew this wasn't some afterlife. This was very much the world I knew.
I can't.
He looked at me and smiled. He spoke softly, but there was a hard edge to his tone. "I'm back, Brian," he said. "I'm going to take care of you."
"I can't escape."
I closed my eyes and prayed for some release. I guess I should explain. This all started a while ago. I got a phone call at home. It was Al. The band wanted to meet. Nothing unusual there, but the meeting was being held at our lawyer's office. That was unusual. It didn't sit well with me. I knew something was up. I grabbed a bag of Coke I had lying around and fixed myself the biggest milkshake you've ever seen. Then I glugged it on the car on the way. I was pretty big back then. Drugs and food, they were my only companions.
I feel like I don't have a single friend in the world.
I arrived at the lawyer's building, the sort of place that lacks any kind of personality, any kind of architecture, a place void of creativity. I headed into the office and saw the whole band, our lawyers and our manager.
These people, these...
I knew what it was before they even spoke. Dennis started it off. "Brian, thanks for coming," he said. He looked sheepish, but sad too, a kind of tired sadness. He handed me this letter. I pulled it open and saw words like regretfully, substance abuse, and assets. One giant word stood out, so big it seemed to fill the paper. Dismissed. They were firing me from the band? The guy who gave them all those hits, all those albums? It was like ice water in my veins.
Freedom seems like an abstract concept.
Al spoke before I could say anything. "We want you to see a doctor," he said. I looked down at his hands and saw he was holding a tape recorder.
Dictaphone.
"You're recording this?" I shouted. "Recording my... I lost my words, and then I spat out the only word on my mind. Murder. It did feel like that. Like they were killing off a part of me. No, not a part. The whole of me.
Myself, my thoughts, and a whole load of blood.
I felt trapped. I suspected for years my dad was bugging me, recording, and listening to me. Here I was again with people who should have loved me, being recorded and monitored, and why? So some quack can tell me what he thinks is going on in my head?
These people, these...
I grabbed the recorder and smashed it against the wall. I ran out of the office into my car. I snorted some coke and drove home straight away. What I didn't know is the band had done this as a ruse to get me some care. They thought if they made it seem like I was out of the band, I'd get help, and I guess it worked. But before it did, something awful happened. I ran into the house, coke ping-ponging around in my bloodstream. I was indestructible.
Like a god.
I ran up to my bedroom where I had this large pot on the nightstand. I pulled the lid off. There were loads of pills inside. Man, there must have been over 100 in there. I grabbed a handful and stuffed them into my mouth.
I can't escape.
Some fell on the floor, but most went into my mouth. I thrust my hand back into the pot and grabbed more, then I did it again and again. I was swallowing hard, no water, just dry pills. They felt terrible in my throat, but I didn't care.
Escape.
My eyes were watering so much, partly from the pills getting stuck, but mainly because I couldn't stop thinking about the letter. Then I gagged. The pills filled the back of my mouth and I couldn't get my breath. I stumbled and fell on the bed. Then everything went black.
Like a dream.
So black.
A bad dream.
I remember spending a lot of time in here, in my mind.
Some days I feel like I'm getting better.
In that blackness.
Other days I feel like I'm falling apart.
Things were so quiet. No voices, no worries, no memories. It was just black and silent. Like I was walking through my mind. But no matter how much I walked, I never ended up anywhere. It was like walking on a treadmill. I did that for a while. Soon it seemed to get slower and slower until finally it stopped and all that remained was blackness and silence, like a vacuum of thought. An infinite nothingness.
Like a dream.
After a while, there was a slither of horizontal light. Small at first, but then it grew and grew. It burned so brightly as this chasm opened up and light flowed in like a burst pipe. I realized it was my eyes, opening and adjusting to that California sunlight I'd known my whole life. And the warmth of the sun, you know. I was awake, alive, back on Earth. They told me later I overdosed, but I wasn't aware of that as I woke up. I turned my head and saw a man next to my bed. He smiled at me and said, "I'm back, Brian. I'm gonna take care of you." That man was Dr. Eugene Landy.
Landy is like a god.
I felt like I'd been saved.
He's omnipresent.
Joy filled my body. I had a sense of safety that I hadn't had for such a long time.
Everywhere in my life.
Turns out that was a false sense of security.
I can't escape.
Because Dr. Landy would soon push me closer to that infinite blackness than those pills ever did. In the beginning, Dr. Landy was good for me. He got my weight down. He made the days better and the nights bearable. He got me off drugs. He made my eyes clear again. Look, there's no two ways about it. He saved my life, and I love him.
Landy is like a god.
I still love him for that. The first time I was in his care, it was good for all of us. But when he came back into my life after that overdose, it wasn't as good.
Like falling apart.
He stopped my contact with almost everyone. All the other guys, girlfriends, anyone, everyone.
Like a god.
He called it 24-hour therapy. I read once in his book that he needed complete control over every aspect of a patient's physical, personal, social, and sexual environments. He wasn't wrong. I couldn't even pick up the phone.
Maybe I wouldn't even want to if I could.
Everywhere I went, I was taken there by Dr. Landy's assistants. I wore a beeper so I could be summoned back by him whenever he needed. There was a strict daily routine. Wake up early, run. God, I was always running. Dr. Landy would drive me to a track and I'd run around it while he was in his car. Then home for a hearty breakfast. Then I was at the piano, writing. Always writing.
I've been trying to write songs.
In the evenings, I was made to show my face around town. Charity events, concerts, anything. He wanted to show the world how well I was doing, how good I was looking. And I was looking good. But everything, everything was under his control. His people were always close.
They come everywhere with me.
I came home one night. I'd been at some show downtown, and Dr. Landy was there in the kitchen, the lights down low.
He's omnipresent.
He asked me if I had a good time. It was the best, Dad, I said. I didn't even realize what I'd said until I saw his face screw up. I apologized. He smiled and said, "Don't mention it, Brian." Then he told me to go to bed. The next morning, I came down to the kitchen and he informed me that the schedule that day was going to be a bit different. "Remind me of that story you told me the other day," he said. I recounted this moment from my childhood we had discussed, about a dog I had when we were kids, this chihuahua named Chico. Man, I love that dog. Chico ended up running away from home.
Escape.
We didn't know where he went. I was distraught. Then one day I was walking home from school with Dennis and we saw Chico lying in the gutter, dead. We both broke down crying.
All I have is myself.
I told Dr. Landy how it had stuck with me. He smiled as I told him the story and then said, "Well," and as if by magic, pulled out this little puppy from under the counter.
Landy is like a god.
I couldn't believe it. It was a chihuahua, just like Chico. I held him so tightly. "What do you want to call him?" he asked. "Buddy," I said right away.
I feel like I don't have a single friend.
Dr. Landy motioned me to the piano. He asked if maybe I could play a new song for our new friend. I placed Buddy on the top of the piano and played some chords. I watched him walk around slowly and then rest, laying down facing me. My heart was filled with ecstasy. "Come on, Brian, let's hear something good. Something new," the doctor said. I tried to conjure up a new melody or even a chord sequence, but I couldn't capture anything.
"I've been trying to write songs."
"Concentrate," Dr. Landy said, putting his hand on my shoulder.
"It's hit and miss."
That's what we did for the next 6 hours. I just sat there as he told me to concentrate. Sometime around that 6 hour mark, he changed. "Fucking focus," he screamed. "It's not that difficult." I was scared. He had been scaring me quite a lot recently, and this wasn't uncommon. But that day, I just felt so vulnerable. He yelled at me again, told me I was letting Buddy down. I just kept saying that I was sorry and kept hitting the keys, hoping something would come. But nothing did.
"I can't do it.
This is a waste of time, a waste of energy," he said. "You don't deserve a present."
"I can't do it on my own."
He grabbed Buddy by the scruff of his neck. Little dog yelped. His little brown eyes had such fear in them. Dr. Landy carried him like that across the room as I begged him to stop. "Please," I shouted. "I can do it, I promise." I began to frantically hit the keys.
"I can't escape."
Dr. Landy turned to me and told me if it didn't come after 6 hours, it wouldn't ever come.
"I can't."
He opened the front door of the house and threw Buddy to the ground. I fell to my knees and begged him not to throw my new friend out.
"These people, these..."
But it was too late. Dr. Landy kicked the dog hard. It ran for its life, and I watched it go down the drive, under the gate, to the road beyond. I screamed and cried, lying there on the floor like a child.
"The falling apart."
He slammed the door and told me I only had myself to blame.
"I feel like I don't have a single friend in the world."
As he walked off, my housekeeper Gloria stood there, her mouth hanging open. She came to me and held me close, told me it was okay, but it didn't feel okay. I felt like my only friend in the world had just deserted me.
"I don't have a single friend."
Later that night, I was lying in bed with the TV on static and all the lights off. There was a knock at my door. It was Gloria. There was panic in her eyes. "Mr. Wilson," she said,
whispering so quietly I could barely hear her. "I'm sorry to tell you this, but I was cleaning the other day and I saw some papers." Her voice drifted off. She nervously looked around the corridor. I told her to come inside my room. She stood in my bedroom that night and spoke so fast I had to ask her to repeat what she said a couple times. She told me Dr. Landy had raised his fees, that he was charging a crazy amount of money for his care.
"Landy is like a god."
She further told me she saw that our manager, Tom, had sanctioned him to receive 25% of the copyright to all my songs, too, regardless of whether he contributed to them or not.
"He's omnipresent."
I couldn't believe it. I was so mad. Mad about this, mad about Buddy, mad about it all.
"Everywhere in my life."
I stormed out of my room and headed for Dr. Landy's bedroom. Gloria tried to hold me back, but she couldn't stop me. I crashed through the door to his bedroom. He was standing there looking at some papers. "Brian, whatever is the matter?" he asked me. I screamed at him. I threw those ridiculous figures his way, told him how hard I'd worked on the songs, told him how he had no right.
"Freedom seems like an abstract concept."
He told me that I'd signed my rights over to him. And then he asked, "Is this all over a damn dog?" With that, I lost it. I flew through the air and punched him first in the ribs.
"Didn't miss."
Then repeatedly in the stomach.
"Didn't miss."
Shouting with every hit, "What have you done to me?" Gloria was behind me in the doorway, screaming for me to stop. Dr. Landy raised his hands up and looked her dead in the eyes and said, No, let him do it. He needs to do it. He needs to release." Sweat was pouring off my head, my knuckles ached. "Hit me, Brian," he screamed. "Hit me!" I drew my arm back, clamped my teeth together, and smashed him right in the face. His lips split open, blood spilled out, he fell back onto the bed. When I looked down at him, he was smiling. Then he looked up at me, and very calmly he said, "Very good."
We'll be right back after this
word.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, It's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a house in your neighborhood that doesn't look so different than yours. A family that everyone feels like they know. A home that is well kept, leaves raked, snow shoveled. Kids playing in a yard on a summer afternoon. Until one day, when their lives are shattered by a killer who comes out of nowhere, or who's been there all along. My name is Matt Marinovich, and for the new season of Murder Homes, I've found homes whose stories are just a little bit darker. We'll talk to a prisoner convicted of first-degree murder, follow a crime scene cleanup crew to a horrific tragedy, take a road trip to a bucolic summer camp in upstate New York, where a preacher buried the bodies of his adoring disciples, and bring you face to face with one of the most unlikely killers of all. Take a walk with me a little further down the street this time and step inside the home that everyone whispers about to relive a day that will always be frozen in time. You can get 100% ad-free exclusive bonus content, including access to early episodes of Murder Homes, by subscribing to the iHeart True Crime Plus channel today, available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Listen to Murder Homes Season 2 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I said that the first time under Dr. Landy's care was good, and it was, but there were red flags I should have seen. An offer came in from Saturday Night Live, directly from its creator, Lorne Michaels, no less. And Landy said it was the perfect opportunity to promote 15 Big Ones, a new Beach Boys album that was doing well on the charts. I've been to SNL before with the boys, and it was fine. This time, Lauren wanted me and me alone. I didn't want to go.
I can't do it on my own.
But Landy forced me to do it. We arrived late. I asked not to rehearse, and they granted my request. I was so nervous. Everyone seemed to think it was going to be so funny and cool. But I could barely talk.
Days just slide by like a bad dream.
I remember John Belushi came up to talk to me, but I didn't say a word, not one. I just couldn't. I was too nervous. At one point, the director came up to me and introduced himself. "I'm Dennis Wilson," he said. "Another Wilson. Another Dennis." He laughed his head off, but I just stared into space.
Freedom seems like an abstract concept.
He walked off after that. The whole day, I felt like I had snakes in my stomach. I hated the idea of doing the show. I was scared of performing, scared of the people in the audience, scared of the people watching back home. I feared that a panic attack was about to set in as I sat in my dressing room, but Landy grabbed me and looked me in the eye. "Come on, Brian," he said. "Where are your guts?"
I wouldn't even want to if I could.
In my mind, my dad's face flashed onto his, and I had to shake my head to get rid of the image. He produced these huge cards from the back of the room and showed them to me. They look like those cards Dylan holds up in the video for Subterranean Homesick Blues. The cards all had different things on them, like laugh, wink, or hold for applause. He said he was going to direct me through the whole thing.
He's omnipresent.
Then I remembered the conversation we had on the car ride over. You told them, right? I asked. About not having the... He looked at me, annoyed. Yes, he said. I've spoken to them about it. They're getting rid of it. It won't be on stage. I felt a shiver run down my back all the way to my ankles. It was interrupted by a knock at the door. Landy opened it to reveal Jody Foster standing on the other side. She was hosting that night and came in to say hello. Landy practically leapt on her. I'm Eugene Landy, he said, smiling. She asked him who he was. I influence all of Brian's thinking, he laughed proudly. But you're not a Beach Boy, she said. She was confused, thought it was all a huge joke. I'm practically a member of the band, he exclaimed, like it was a known fact. Before I knew it, we were on the side of the stage. My least favorite place.
I can't do it on my own.
Landy told me I was up next. He tapped his cards and pointed to where he was going to be, right in front of the stage. I heard the director yell, "Okay, commercial break is ending in 30. My heart rattled in my ribs. Then he turned to me and shouted, "Don't forget this is live, Brian." I felt like I couldn't breathe.
I can't escape.
Landy said his goodbyes and made his way to his position. That's when I saw it. They wheeled out this grand piano. But that's not what was taking my focus. The thing that was dragging all the oxygen from my lungs and the steadiness from my feet was what the piano was sitting in. A huge sandbox.
A bad dream.
I asked them not to do it. I pleaded. Landy promised me. 23 seconds, the director called out. My mind flashed back to writing Smile, to being in that sandbox on that piano. I blinked and saw the tapes for Mrs. O'Leary's Cow burning, the fires in L.A. Then I heard my dad screaming at me for being useless. Then I heard Phil Spector. 18 seconds now, came the director's voice again. My throat tightened.
Can't escape.
Landy, I shouted. You promised. They wouldn't use the sandbox. He shrugged. We're live in 12, the director shouted.
I feel like I'm falling apart.
Someone pushed me on stage and I gingerly walked into the sand pit and sat at the piano while the director made the final countdown. Live in 5, 4, 3. Then he went silent and counted the last 2 seconds with just his fingers. I thought those 2 seconds would never end. All I heard was my heart. All I felt was that damn sand under my feet. I've always hated the beach. Have I told you that already? I fucking hate it. Someone must have introduced me because the crowd was cheering and the director was pointing at me. I started Good Vibrations by missing around half of the opening notes, but I quickly recovered. The fear had started to subside and I thought I might be able to put out a performance to make Landy proud. To make myself proud.
Like a dream.
He was holding up his cards constantly. Good, one read. Another one read, don't forget to look at the audience. I hated that one, but I did it anyway. He fumbled a card, and there was a second or two where he was holding up nothing. I suddenly thought, I don't need Landy and his cards. I can do this by myself. I drew in another breath and moved on to the second section of the song, almost enjoying myself by this point. Landy held another card, but I didn't look at it. I scanned the audience and then went back to the piano. As I looked up, the card came into view. It was just a word, a small word, only 5 letters, but it filled both my eyes. It seemed to fill the entire auditorium. No, the entire world. My entire world.
All I have is myself, my thoughts.
I read it and heard screeching. I saw it all again. I looked down at the sandbox, and it only made it worse.
A bad dream.
I was panicking, even more scared than before. I didn't want to do this anymore. There were too many memories, too many bad memories. Landy still held the card up high. He moved it closer to me, motioning hard. Do it, he mouthed.
Landy is like a god.
The word on the card simply said, smile. But I couldn't. I felt like maybe I never would again.
Maybe I wouldn't even want to if I could.
That word, that was the thing that had ruined it all. It brought me here. It brought me Landy. It had brought me to drugs and alcohol and those never-ending voices. I never wanted to see the word smile ever again. As I limped to the end of that performance, I swore to myself that I'd erase that word from my life. But it's funny. Sometimes the thing that haunts you can save you. It turns out smile wasn't the end. Maybe we'll get to that soon.
...1986, Los Angeles. Melinda Ledbetter is standing on the showroom floor of the Martin Cadillac dealership, gazing out through the huge floor-to-ceiling windows. She watches as raindrops fall onto the windowpane. "I haven't seen weather this bad in forever," her colleague yells at her. "LA, in the rain, like this." He continues to talk, but Melinda is only half listening. She's watching a man outside move slowly down the street. He walks with little confidence, like he's only learned how just recently. He appears scared to take every step. And behind him are two other men, both dressed in blazers, with their sleeves pushed up to their elbows and sunglasses dangling from their breast pockets. Suddenly, all three men make a beeline for the dealership door. Melinda puts on her game face. "Hello, gentlemen," she beams as they walk inside, water dripping onto the polished floor. This is the dance she's done 1,000 times before, and it's a dance she's the best at. She engages the men in some small talk about the weather and then the Los Angeles Lakers. And then she drops the line. "So, what can I do for you today?" This is her golden line. It continues the fiction that she's not just there to sell them a car, but it also moves the conversation onto just that, the sale. The man in the middle, who has said almost nothing so far, finally looks her in the eye. I need a car," he says. "Cadillac." He walks over to a mud-brown 1985 Seville and points to it. "This one?" he shrugs. Melinda looks at the man properly for the first time and sees how unhappy he looks, how jaded he appears. And the other two men walk slowly around the showroom as Melinda opens the door of the Seville. "Jump in and take a look before you drive off. I don't want to get rid of you that quickly," she jokes, tapping him on the shoulder. Melinda and the man slide into the car's front seats, puts his head into the headrest and closes his eyes. "Comfy, right?" she says, but he doesn't reply. She fills the silence with another question. "You know, before we go any further, I should probably ask your name." The man's eyes are still closed. He breathes out slowly and almost painfully says, "Brian Wilson." Melinda smiles and begins to ask if he wants to take it for a test drive, but she's cut off as Brian loudly slams the door, and then he locks the car. "There's an automatic lock feature, as you can see," she says, half joking but entirely anxious. And she calmly moves her hand to her pocket and feels around for the bottle of mace she keeps there. She begins to ask him to unlock the car, but he turns to her with tears in his eyes. He positions the rearview mirror to look at the men with him. And those men, he loses his train of thought. Melinda asks if they're his friends. "No, not friends," he says. "Co-workers? Bodyguards?" Brian shakes his head to answer both questions. "No," he replies, "my captors." Melinda looks around, expecting to see that she's on a hidden camera show, but the showroom is still. Then she sees one of the men in the side mirror, his eyes burning as he stares at the car. She tells Brian that she can call the police if needed. "No cops," he yells. As he does, Melinda sees the two men talk to each other as they continue to look at the car. "Get me out of here," Brian pleads. Melinda doesn't know why she believes Brian, but she does. The men he is with give her a bad feeling, while the man sitting next to her seems nervous and vulnerable. She doesn't think, she just acts. "Okay, Brian," she says, "I want you to start the car." She looks at the floor-to-ceiling windows of the dealership and at the LA rain outside. Brian turns the key and the motor kicks in. She pulls the handbrake off and tells him to put it in drive. And for the first time, she hears the tension in her own voice. She glances in the side mirror and watches the two men start to walk over. She moves her hand at the back of the rearview mirror when she presses a bulky red button, and the large motorized window in front of her begins to slowly move to its left, revealing the LA downpour. She knows they have 23 seconds before the thing is fully open. The two men begin to move more quickly now, dodging other Cadillacs as they come in their direction. As soon as I shout now, you're going to want to drive as fast as you can, she says to Brian, right through that open window. Brian nods. The rain sounds loud in the showroom now. Not yet, Melinda whispers. Brian stares ahead. Not yet, her voice raises as she watches the window move achingly slow. Not yet, she shouts, this time as Brian's hand grips the wheel so tightly his knuckles go white. The two men are close now. So close that one of them reaches out and can just about touch the car. Melinda can't hold it any longer. Now, she shouts. The car screeches into life, throwing itself forward. One of Brian's captors slams his fist into the window of Melinda's side as the car moves forward, and the other falls as he tries to grab the door handle on Brian's side. Melinda's co-workers stand and watch. Brian rounds the corner, and they're off, out of the lot. Their celebrations are short-lived. Brian Wilson screeches the car to a halt because standing in the road in front of them is a man soaked from the rain, smiling ear to ear. Do you know that guy? Melinda cries. Brian nods his head. He looks devastated. Yeah, he says. That's Dr. Eugene Landy. The man in the road moves to the car, and as he does, Melinda listens to the rain on the window. Only moments ago, it had sounded like a victory song. But now, all it sounds like is just blood on the tracks. Blood on the Tracks is produced by Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. It's hosted and executive produced by me, Jake Brennan. Also executive produced by Brady Sadler. Zeth Lundy is lead editor and producer. This episode was written by Ben Burrow. Mixing and sound design by Colin Fleming. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. This season features Chris Anzalone as the voice of Brian Wilson. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. Follow Double Elvis on Instagram at Double Elvis and on Twitch at Disgraceland Talks. And you can talk to me, per usual, on Instagram and Twitter at Disgraceland Pod. Rock and roll.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.